Welcome to the Healing Ground Movement, a podcast dedicated to revolutionizing how we think about our bodies and our health. I'm your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, DC, and I have lived my life in pursuit of holistic healing and care that goes beyond symptom management. If you've been listening and like what you're hearing, head over to your favorite platform and leave us a review so we can reach more people with our important message. Enjoy today's episode. Welcome to another episode of the Healing Ground Movement. I'm your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, and today I'm coming to you with a little bit of an asthma flare-up. So I do apologize for the tone of my voice. I hope that it is still understandable and that the energy carries through, but I've been struggling this week. But it's really important to me that we get to have this conversation with our guest today, Dr. Scott Cunningham, because he is a conventionally trained internal medicine physician who also offers his patients integrative care, which uses nutritional and other biological strategies to reverse chronic illness. He was diagnosed with his own chronic illness, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, a chronic systemic autoimmune condition considered irreversible by conventional medicine teaching. Being driven to understand how biological systems work, the unrelenting symptoms of his own autoimmunity drove Dr. Cunningham to learn how to reverse his own autoimmune condition. His passion is to offer the same approach to his patients as an alternative to a pill for every ill. So welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Cunningham.
Well, thank you for being here.
I appreciate it. Well, we always like to start off with a little get-to-know-you question,
Yeah. Which
is, when was movement first fun for you?
Actually, thank you for asking. And it was a memory to think about that, actually. So I actually wrote it down.
All right.
It was running solo around the perimeter of the playground. I think that I was probably could have been fifth grade.
Yeah.
In view of the entire PE class. I think it was like a victory lap. That's my recollection. And just feeling the pure joy of running gracefully, almost like an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And then having one of my classmates affirming how graceful it was to watch.
Oh, that's really cool.
Isn't that neat?
So you had the internal experience of it, but then also that validation outside of it.
Yes.
And did you continue running, or how did that spark anything in you?
Yes. Well, I ended up running pretty much every day of my life starting at about age 15. I was in track and field before that, but I started running as a means of getting a good night's sleep, actually, when I was 15, because I had some difficulty sleeping. And I did that pretty much for 40 years.
Oh, wow. So that really became a part of you, just
it,
that
it
moment
did.
In PE.
It really did.
Yeah.
It really did.
Wonderful. Yeah. So are you still, you said for 40 years, are you still running now, or do you do other things for movement fun?
Yeah, I mostly walk. I actually live like three blocks from my office, so, and I always have a lot of weight, you know, different materials, learning materials, and business materials in my two bags. So I carry my bags to work, which is, you know, three blocks back and forth, and that's a lot of my exercise, and I kind of, you know.
Move them around.
Move them around, yeah. Yeah, so.
I think that's awesome. Well,
I actually got to the point in my story where my knees were hurting so bad, and this is about probably 4 years ago, that I couldn't run without severe pain and thinking that I was going to end up in a wheelchair later that day. But now I can run if I want to. It's just it's not fitting in the same way as it did.
So what changed to make you be able to get back to running if you so desired?
Yeah, well, that's basically my medical testimony. And you know, if you want to dive into that now, we could.
Would that work? That'd be wonderful. Before we go there, I really love, though, that you find functional movement in your life. It's something that we talk about in a lot of other episodes, but this idea that you don't have to make time to go to the gym or run laps or whatever, but your commute to your office carrying weights in your arms that are not dumbbells, but the tools you need for the day is just a very appropriate and acceptable form of your exercise. So I wanted to call that out as a really fantastic example that you're setting.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And then I would love to segue into your medical testimonial, because that is a really cool story. We hear so many medical conditions that are as good as they're going to get, or untreatable, uncurable. And the more we learn, the less we find that to be true.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So about four, you know, I've been practicing medicine since about 1990. But in about 4 years ago, I got an email from a gentleman who is basically a kind of a marketer of integrative practices. And he said, you know, dear doctor, are you aware that integrative practitioners are getting significant traction with with chronic illnesses? And I thought, oh, I'd never had heard that. Mm-hmm. And so I looked into it, and sure enough, ended up in a mentorship program, found my own clinician, integrative clinician. And my integrative clinician diagnosed me with Hashimoto's thyroiditis using the antibodies. My mm-hmm. my levels had always been fine and still were, but mm-hmm. the antibodies were positive, the thyroid antibodies.
Yeah, and could you talk to a little bit about that? I don't know if that's really quite common knowledge that when we get our thyroid tested, very often we test for the thyroid hormone itself. But tell us about this antibody part that was found out in you.
Right, mm-hmm. right. So there is a concept that's been around for, well, definitely decades. I don't know if it goes back a century or not necessarily in conventional medicine, mm-hmm. you know, because I'm an MD, right? Medical school and all that. And it's the concept of autoimmunity. Mm-hmm. So typical autoimmune conditions are like multiple sclerosis, lupus, Crohn's disease, mm-hmm. ulcerative colitis, things like that. Mm-hmm. And one of those conditions is actually Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Mm-hmm. And the teaching in conventional circles is that Hashimoto's thyroiditis attacks the thyroid. Actually, what happens is that the immune system gets a little confused and starts attacking your thyroid, which is basically the little gland around your Adam's apple. And it eventually burns out the thyroid so that you don't produce enough thyroid hormone to be able to support basically your metabolism. Mm-hmm. And so when that happens, then what the typical, you know, conventionally trained approach is, we'll give you a thyroid pill. Mm-hmm. And then that replaces your thyroid. But you have to kind of look into the little deeper into the conventional medical literature to realize that there are actually things that go along with the fact that not only has your thyroid been attacked by your own immune system, but mm-hmm. it also can attack things like the joints and can cause like heart disease mm-hmm. and is related tangentially to other autoimmune conditions. And, you know, as a practicing primary care physician for years, I never really thought about those things, partly because I wasn't digging that much into the literature. Mm-hmm. I just gave the, you know, it's a pill for every ill, right? Just mm-hmm. write out the prescription for Mrs. Jones,
yeah.
right? And that's what everybody did. All my colleagues were doing that.
You're replacing the hormone that's no longer really available because the gland has been attacked, but you're not getting rid of the attack program.
Right, right. And now in my case, mm-hmm. Well, let me back up a little bit. So mm-hmm. it's not just the thyroid that's being attacked by the autoimmunity. It mm-hmm. turns out that many of, if not all of your tissues are being attacked on some level with, mm-hmm. you know, by this autoimmunity. So in my case, my knees were taking a real hit, mm-hmm. you know. And so so I started, you know, back to my story. So I started, you know, I got rid of gluten. I got rid of, you know, sugar as much as I could, et cetera. And at that point, I was negotiating. You know how you negotiate mm-hmm. in health?
Yeah.
Let's just get real here.
As someone currently suffering an asthma attack, I just don't have a clue what you're saying. Yes, we negotiate in health. You know, it's quality of life versus what can you do about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So now in my case, I I'd heard that, you know, you really should avoid dairy, you know, and stuff like that. But I wasn't aware of the literature, and I didn't want to take the risk. And I really loved my cheese.
Does taste good.
You know, now I was able to get rid of ice cream, but the cheese, that was a little different. Right?
We all have our weakness. I'm with you. Ice cream can go, but man, a nice brie, it's hard.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So I eventually I bit the bullet. I said, okay, I'm just going to give this a try. You know, it's going to be hard. Actually, it wasn't as hard as I thought it would be once I made the decision that, okay, my knees are, it's either a wheelchair or forget the cheese. You know, that was my thinking. And so it actually worked probably about maybe 60%, maybe 40-50%, something like that. Now, in my case, I had to start to query the literature and what other practitioners were doing, because I wanted the rest of that 40%, because my knees were not close to perfect. They're better, but so I had to actually learn how to detoxify my system. And you know, kind of put that together, you know, kind of on my own.
Yeah.
And but that was the thing that got me from from 60% to, you know, and I'm currently probably at maybe 98%.
Yeah.
It's not perfect, you know, but that's certainly a lot better.
You have a lot of your quality of life back, and certainly walking to work every day carrying all of your bags instead of being in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a remarkable difference.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit then about sort of the difference between your traditional medical training and what that next level of creating an integrative or functional medicine approach is? Because I think there's a lot of assumptions about what traditional medical training knows and says about the physiological symptoms. And I certainly hear often in my practice that an MD will say that you know, diet is fine, but it's not really going to move the needle. And these things aren't really going to do anything. So what's the education and an assumption that's kind of happening between these two schools of thought?
Yeah, you know, in conventional medical training, diet doesn't really enter into much of anything anytime.
Mm-hmm. Do you get dietary instruction in your education?
Yeah, we had a week.
Okay. So one week of diet nutrition.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, it's interesting to think about it. It was back in the second year of medical school.
Yeah.
And it was actually impactful for me.
Oh, good.
In a way, because they talked about, now this is back in the like mid-80s, okay, you know, but they talked about, you know, eating more vegetables, and it was mostly that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, so I really tried to implement it. And I didn't really understand how to integrate that into my lifestyle at all. And so I probably spent more time cooking than maybe I should have, if I would have been a little smarter about it.
Yeah.
But I was trying, you know, because I could see the value of it.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it eventually just kind of evaporated away, you know.
Yeah.
And because nobody at medical conferences ever talked about you know, dietary things. Now the one difference is probably in when it comes to diabetes and heart disease, heart failure, to some extent, doctors, conventional, you know, doctors would talk about salt intake. They'd talk about carbohydrate intake, and they, to some extent, talk about, you know, fatty intake and stuff like that. And a lot of that was, I would consider, kind of misguided now, and, you know, we can talk about that a little later.
Because a lot of the recommendations for diabetic diets and everything have changed, that, you know, higher good fat diets are far more impactful as opposed to the no fat diets that were originally prescribed.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, we're learning so much, I think, is the real takeaway.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So have I answered your question?
Yeah. I think it's a fair point. It's something that we've talked about through my training and, you know, years back in the 80s, looking at the numbers. It seems like it hasn't changed much. Maybe it is changing now that it's more than a week. But from what I understand, traditional medical training still has, you know, about 10 hours of nutrition. And that's, you know, and then it doesn't get repeated and the drum doesn't get beat on it. But what we find with chiropractic and functional medicine is that becomes one of the main tools in our toolbox, right. You know, that we had two quarters on it and loads of continuing education available about not just what Eat More Vegetables can do, but what finding food sensitivities and good fats and implementing nutraceuticals, which is a way of talking about supplements that are at a very high grade level, you know, better than the over-the-counter that might be, you know, cheapened with fillers,
right.
But using high grade supplements to fill in the pieces, you know, it's a drum that's beat really hard in other circles. But maybe, you know, and traditional medical training has a lot of other really fantastic tools that when our bodies get so beyond what we can bounce back from, then we really need those tools. But there's a lot of leeway before we get there.
Yeah, that's actually a good way to describe how conventional medicine is set up, because conventional medicine is most of the tools for conventional medicine are for the end stage of disease processes, whether it's, you know, heart disease, whether it's, you know, somebody with you know, high blood pressure or diabetes or but not early in the process.
It's sort of the difference between, we were having a conversation at my home about early detection versus early intervention. And so I think there's a lot of people that would like to say that early intervention is getting that blood screening and looking at things like your blood pressure. And that's really, I'm sorry, it's not early intervention, it's preventative medicine. So clarify myself. So preventative medicine versus early detection. So when you do blood screening and you're finding things like, you know, your cholesterol is high, or you have an infection, your white blood cells are off, or your high blood pressure, that's early detection. So that means that by the time you end up within a scary number range, you're already deep within the disease, the cardiovascular disease, diabetes, all of that. By the time you trip those numbers to be noticed by conventional medicine, as you put it, it's that end stage area where we need pharmaceuticals to intervene on our behalf. But true preventative medicine are all the things that you do before you end up in that range. So things like yoga and meditation and dietary changes and drinking enough water and walking to work and detoxes, that's the true preventative medicine and sort of the difference in there.
Actually, you know, when when you first brought this the subject out just now, you used a terminology that I haven't heard before, but I actually like the terminology. And it's the idea. The first thing you said was early detection versus early intervention. I actually like the terminology of early intervention. In fact, I'm going to write that down. Has it been patented yet?
Oh, I've got some lawyers working on it.
But that's actually what it, I may be getting ahead.
Oh, please.
But that's what I would like to do in my practice is early intervention. You know, because there's so much that can be done before the numbers go off the charts, or even before a lot of symptoms start. You know, prevention, I guess you could say that, you know, prevention is kind of the same thing as early intervention, but I like the idea of early intervention. The problem is in real life is that most people don't get motivated to make fundamental lifestyle changes mm-hmm. until they have a symptom like me with my knees,
yeah.
right? That you just can't ignore it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's when it comes to lifestyle changes, it does often get weighed out between wheelchair or cheese, you know? Mm-hmm. And if I can get away with eating my cheese as long as I can, then I think I will. And we mm-hmm. have to have something to motivate us to change our behavior, which is a sticking point we come up to a lot in these conversations, is how I think it's a little bit needs to be bent along how can we change our expectations of what medicine and healthcare really ought to be. Because if we have this idea that early intervention or early detection, we need to wait until we are symptomatic, then we think there's almost this misconception of we are inherently healthy until we are suddenly not. You know, mm-hmm. I am healthy until I am diabetic. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not a light switch that gets thrown. Right. I am healthy with blood sugar that is creeping up. It's sort of near that worrisome number, but I'm still fine. And then I wake up one morning and now I'm definitely not fine.
It's more like a dimmer switch.
It really is. And so how can we be aware of what's going on in our bodies and take responsibility for it in a rather unconventional medical way and say, I'm going to choose lifestyle and nutrition changes. You know, I think really our goal should be to live a healthy and good quality life is to not find ourselves in a medical office, because that means we've let things go too far.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, I think to me, I think that if there's a way that we can give people permission mm-hmm. to have really high standards for their health.
Mm.
To me, that's kind of the common thing that I see.
Yeah, I love that. Permission to have really high standards for your health.
Right. And I think that that's not at all universal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now for me, I always just wanted to feel really good. If I didn't feel really good, I knew there was something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to people over the years that, you know, whether patients or not patients, you know, they might say, oh, I just had this nagging, you know, back pain, it's not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hello? I couldn't live with that.
Yeah.
My personal standards are, it has to be perfect. If I don't feel perfect, there's something wrong. And I've always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that if we can, you know, give our listeners some permission to say, look, it's possible to feel perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe not absolutely perfect, but pretty close.
Well, when you start talking about that with all the changes you've made, you're at 98%.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that's not 100%, and it's not going to be 98% 100% of the time, but it's definitely not 60%. It's definitely not nagging pain. And I know that I've mentioned before on the show that I have a medical history that includes having H. flu meningitis, which gave me a lot of movement issues initially right off the bat. It was when I was 9 months old. So by about the time I was a year and a half, I was still kind of falling over and running into walls and just did not have my coordination about me. And I was released from traditional medical care and PT with as good as it's going to get. This is your quality of life now.
And that's it.
And that's the standard for where it's at. And now, having done a lot of unconventional things throughout my life, I can say that, asthma aside, still working on that, work in progress. Yeah. But my movement in my body, I'm at about 95%.
Right.
I am getting really close to not being able to call myself an individual with an invisible handicaps anymore, because it's that relentless idea of, I deserve better. And frankly, mm-hmm. so does everybody else.
Yes.
There's nothing that makes you special because you have Hashimoto's and I have brain damage. We just decided to keep asking for better.
Right.
And I would love if everybody would keep asking for better.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And that's what you're doing in your practice with these different alternatives.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the difference is, you know, we were talking before we went on that mm-hmm. about the difference, the kind of the fundamental difference between conventional medicine and integrative care.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in conventional medicine, you know, that's all the doctors had to offer you. They saved your life. What more do you want?
And I'm grateful. I mean, dead. 5% chance of survival. Please save me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And but with integrative tools, I have the tools to get, you know, and you've accessed those tools also, you know, to get people the rest of the way, not just breathing, but, you know, let's get you to 95 or 98 or whatever percent, you know, but a person has to want it.
True.
And that's kind of the missing link in pretty much 100% of the case. Can I just say it like that? You know, I mean.
I think so. I think there is definitely a desire to want it. And I think there's also an understanding of where to get it too. Because I've seen often that wanting it is, you know, it's a little seed, because it's almost audacious when you're looking around at our culture, where such a high percentage of us here in the United States are living in chronic pain or living with an autoimmune or chronic disease. So it's an audacious thought to say, I want to feel 100%, because no one in your office is saying they're feeling 100%. And then you go to your conventional doctor and say, I want to feel better than I am. What are some other tools that I can have? And very often the answer is, here's your pill. What more do you want from me?
Right.
And I think some better communication and accessibility between my training as a conventional doctor is to save your life. Here are resources for quality of life. And that could really nurture and grow this idea that I want and deserve more. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Sign me up.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's what I live for, I think.
Yeah. You know? And I certainly see a trend now that a lot more traditionally trained doctors, medical doctors, are starting to find their way into that integrative world. I mean, I have a neighbor right upstairs and one down the hall and you sitting here. And I think that's more than just about anybody could find when you were starting your own Hashimoto's journey.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You have to put a lot of the effort in yourself to get there.
I think that it's going to feel like, I guess we can just encourage our listeners. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to feel like a DIY, do-it-yourself project to some extent. And it doesn't exactly have to be, but it has to feel like it's a DIY that you then, as part of your journey, you keep reaching out for help until you find the help that you need. And you may need to continue to reach out for other help too, in order to get to where you need to be. And I'll just, you know, use my own journey that, you know, I had to find my own clinician. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, 4 years ago. And I was doing a lot on my own. You can ask Marjorie, my wife, I was doing a lot, you know, a lot of research and changed our diet, you know, kicking and screaming, some of us, you know, and stuff. But I literally kind of hit a plateau where I literally didn't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. And so that's when, you know, the student's ready. So the professor shows up. So that's when I found my, you know, integrative clinician. Mm-hmm. And then I even maxed out with my very smart integrative clinician. And then I had to, you know, find other resources, even, you know, so it never stops.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would just encourage people to have that sort of, it's like a hunger,
yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, when you're hungry, it's like, you know, what can we eat? You know?
give me more.
Right.
But what I like also is that the way you're describing that journey is it's sort of accepting the humanity of what you're able to give yourself and then what each clinician or provider is able to give you. Right. It's not necessarily this old style of white coat worship where, you know, you went to your doctor, you know everything. And when you say there's not another option, that's it. It's this appreciation of we're all humans and we all know what we know. And then somebody else knows more about something else. Mm-hmm. You know, you have your specialty in autoimmune and Hashimoto's and thyroiditis. I have my specialty in functional movement and rehab neurology. Right. And so if someone came to me with questions about thyroid, the answers I'd be able to give them are, you know, bargain basement, despite the fact that we're both doctors.
Right, right.
They're bargain basement answers, opposed to giving someone who has made it their life's passion to know what your options are.
Right.
And you just have to be willing to continue looking and asking for the next the next clinician with the right obsession.
The next clinician with the right obsession. I like that.
Yeah, because that's what we need. We need someone to obsess about an area of our health as much as we do, because that's what it takes to find the answers, in my experience, throughout my own journey.
Yeah, you're right.
So do you notice now, working with patients on both the conventional medicine side and the integrative side, are there misconceptions that patients bring into your office with ideas on either side of that coin? Expectations?
Misconceptions about integrative medicine?
Mm-hmm. Or about what conventional medicine can do for their chronic disease. You know, I mean, the expectations can go both ways.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What I would say, how I'd answer that is that in general, people have over expectations of what conventional medicine can do, and even more exaggerated under expectations of what integrative medicine can do.
Interesting. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. Well, I'll use one of my patients. We'll just call her Jane. That's not a real name. So Jane, I'm not saying that she had, you know, missed expectations or anything, but this just illustrates kind of the, you know, how this all works. So she had been a very healthy child, even to the point of being a tomboy, you know, and beating the boys in arm wrestling until their hormones changed. All right. But then when she was 32, she injured her back. And then, inexplicable to her, all the muscles in her arms and legs started to hurt. Mm-hmm. And like in her upper, you know, torso, just out of the blue. She had never had pain like that before. And so she ended up seeing, you know, dozens of doctors over the years, ended up just, you know, a pill for every ill. And then she came to me when she was about 52, so 20 years of suffering, right?
That's
a long journey. These symptoms. And I was just learning at the time, I was just learning about integrative approaches. And so I said one time she was in the office, I said, you know, Jane, I'm learning some things that might really help you with this. I'm not sure, but I'm starting to get some results with this. So she said, well, what is it? And in her case, she didn't know really anything about integrative care. So that's the ultimate under expectation, right?
It's not knowing it
exists. Not knowing anything about it. Okay. So
fair point.
So I said, well, you know, it let's start with some basic food choice changes. We talked about, you know, getting her off gluten, getting her off dairy, getting rid of the processed sugar, and just basic things like that. And she said, well, you know, let me think about it. Now's not a really good time. That's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't pressure my patients, you know, because it has to be kind of organic.
Yeah.
Right. And so 6 months later, she came back and she said, okay, I'm ready. And we reviewed stuff. 2 weeks later, all the pain was gone.
Amazing.
Now, I'd never seen that before. As a conventional doctor, you never see that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all diet. So that's an example of, you know, what conventional medicine did for her or didn't do for her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least it kept her alive, I guess.
Yeah.
Kept her somewhat functional. But then, you know, with some basic dietary changes, the pain's gone.
Mm-hmm.
That actually, her story, I think you're really going to like this from a movement standpoint, because the story continues.
Oh, please
okay?
go on.
I mean, she's still my patient.
Yeah.
So we moved even beyond food choice changes to more of a detoxification protocol.
Mm.
And we can talk about details, some details about that if you want. But so as she detoxified her system, I asked her one time, so how's it going? She said, you know, it's so neat because And she's an exerciser. She's always been an exerciser, you know. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, she actually had moved into the foothills. And so now she's, you know, in a mountainous setting, right? So she likes to hike and stuff. So she said, yeah, it's, you know, the more we do this, integrative approach, basically, especially with detoxification, she said, my endurance has gone from getting pooped out after a half a mile to I can go for miles and not get tired.
Oh, fabulous. Good for her.
Isn't that amazing?
And she gets her quality of life back.
You can't fake that.
No, you really can't. Well, and I think that's the amazing thing of how we were talking at the beginning about expecting more for your health and not settling for anything less than 100%.
Right.
Is that, you know, there's always something more depending on where the embodiment of quality of life means to you.
Right.
You know, and I think some people might choose the cheese over the wheelchair, but I think most of us really want to have that mobility and ability to, you know, do everything that we love and that we're passionate about. Go running in the foothills, walk to work. And there's really no end to trying what you can get back.
I totally agree.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you feel like that's an ideological difference between conventional medicine versus integrative medicine? This idea of, you know, getting as good as it gets versus never say never?
Do you want to open this can of worms
Let's
now?
Open this can of worms. I'm all for opening cans of worms.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, okay. Well, how I can answer that like on a dozen, you know, different levels.
All right, but, you're the expert here, so go for it.
Okay. So, well, they're totally different ideological. The conventional medical model right now is actually it's not so much a scientific ideology as it is it's almost like a commercial ideology.
Really? Tell us a little bit more about that, because I think the general expectation is that it's science based and this non-conventional stuff is not so much.
Yeah.
So tell me a little more about that.
So remember, you were the one that asked this question.
Yeah.
So medical knowledge is based on the studies that are done and published in the medical journals.
Mm-hmm.
And the medical studies are funded by dollars from a particular place.
Mm-hmm.
And the common denominator of most of those studies goes back to the pharmaceutical industry because it is a the pharmaceutical industry is a big source of funding. I mean, there's a lot of dollars that flow through the pharmaceutical industry. medications can be monetized easier than, you know, somebody that's the best masseuse in the world or knows how to teach people how to have the best diet in the world or, you know, the best mindset in the world from a health perspective or whatever. But it's really easy to monetize drugs.
They can be patented and trademarked and flow of money goes back to one source.
Right. Right. And so, and even to the point that the medical school curriculums are based on what's in the journals, and what's in the journals is based on the, you know, the grants that ultimately kind of flow back to the pharmaceutical companies oftentimes. Okay, so now you have a whole cadre of doctors that have been, you know, raised listening to professors talk to them about basically, well, you know, here's a pill that works for this ill.
Mm-hmm.
And so that that's what you talk about is what's, you know, been monetized.
Yeah.
And so it all flows around that. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It sounds like it's sort of self-perpetuating.
It is.
And I heard at some point too, and I think it was Harvard Medical that didn't receive a very good grade as far as investment of teachers who hold stock within pharmaceutical research, teaching about that pharmaceutical research. And so even within the school, the teachers benefit from teaching about the pill that they are researching to benefit from it because they're, you know, there's a whole new generation of doctors prescribing along with it.
Yeah.
Now it makes that 10 hours of nutrition make a lot of sense because, like you were saying, you know, you can't patent vitamin D. No one's going to make money off of spending more time in the sun.
Or broccoli.
Yeah, or broccoli. Yeah, no one's going to make more money off of broccoli. But when you talk about your patient who's now running among the foothills, yeah, that's what changed her life, the broccoli, among other things.
Yeah, among other things.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there's this really ideologically entrenched idea that, you know, these are the resources that we have within the medical training, and it's self-perpetuating. And it's easy to see how the public would take that as scientific knowledge because it's coming out of scientific journals. You know, why wouldn't we call it science if it's coming out of there? But I think it bears a lot of reasoning to understand that, you know, we need to know where the incentive for this research is coming. You know, and that even throughout CDC and the American Association of Pediatrics, that those are also being heavily funded by these pharmaceutical companies. So a lot of the recommendations we're getting are financially incentivized.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of sad but true.
Yeah, I imagine because you know this is your profession. I'm in counterculture over here as a chiropractor. We're right. we're the crazies.
Yeah, bless your heart.
we're doing what we can. But what would you like to see change? Being that this is, you know, this is part of your education and what you stand for, but it's also wanting the better help for your patients. How do you negotiate that?
Well, I think what we're doing right now is is probably a lot what needs to happen because what I find is that when I talk to somebody and give them what the actual scientific basis of something, they're kind of ruined then. They really can't go back.
Yeah.
And so, you know, information is, you know, like we were talking about before, information is so powerful that if this information were to get out and hit the eardrums of people, it will change them.
I think so. I hope so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that there's an old saying that the truth will set you free. You know, once you hear the truth, you can't go back because there's something about the truth that, you know, it like resonates with you. It probably resonates on a quantum level, right?
Yeah.
And it changes you and you're never the same.
Mm-hmm.
But if truth is withheld from an entire population, which it basically has for decades now, definitely in the last decade, now that we have a lot of access to this stuff. You know, the misinformation can actually, I mean, this is really heavy, but misinformation can kill people.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more about that. I think it's a really important point. I mean, when we talk about that misinformation, it's the idea that, you know, this is all we've got for you. And or we've done this population study and this is the medication necessary for you. But if you know more about your own health, your dietary needs, your blood work on a deeper physiological level, you might find out that medication might not save you from the ill that you're experiencing and may actually cause, you know, I'm trying to stop saying side effects because they are just effects of the medication. We just don't like them. It may cause effects that will ultimately end up killing you in the long run.
Right. Yeah. I would say that my perspective on that is, and maybe it's a more fundamental, you know, perspective, but to me, taking, like, let's say diabetes medication, okay, and, you know, I still prescribe my patients diabetes medications if they need it, if that's where they're at.
Yeah.
Okay.
We still,
because it's better, than not taking the diabetes medicine. Actually, I have a story I may tell about that, but
please.
But the way that I look at medicines is if a medicine, even if a medicine doesn't have any particular side effects, okay, but like say it's a diabetes medication, you're taking a diabetes medication, even if it doesn't have any side effects, if you're not treating the root cause that's causing the diabetes, then the diabetic condition is going to you know, cause lots of problems fundamentally with your system, you know, whether kidney disease, heart problems, you know, stroke, eye problems. So can I tell you the story?
Please.
So one of my patients, I'll call him Bill. And you know, I've taken care of him for, you know, many, many years actually. But you know, Bill's diabetic, very healthy metabolically. In fact, he had some chest pains a few years ago, and he ended up with getting a heart catheterization and a thallium at that time a treadmill test or a stress test, and in his coronaries were clean as a whistle, which is really actually a little unusual for a long-standing diabetic, you know?
Yeah.
And he's on diabetic, a couple of different diabetic, you know, medications. And his blood sugar control has never been that great because he just has never been that motivated to really dig in and do the dietary things that, that we've, you know, I've always talked to him about that.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like,
am I still blue in the face?
Yeah.
Anyway, I really like Bill. And, you know, we have a great relationship. But it's very interesting that one day he came in and he said, Doc, I don't know what's going on. I'm seeing this dark thing in my vision. It seems to be coming from my right eye. And I said, well, when did that start? Today. And he was just happened to be in my office.
Good timing.
I said, dude, you need to call the eye doctor.
Yeah.
Like now, you know, I mean, not literally right now.
But yeah. But
I said, you know, it could be a detached retina. Mm-hmm. It could be, who knows what it is.
But again, it's that dimmer switch getting louder and louder and louder that now he has a symptom in his eye that he noticed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so he ended up, you know, seeing the eye doctor, and I'm pretty sure that particular thing, it actually was a threatened detachment. And then, but he also ended up, even though he had been seeing the eye doctor for a long time, there was something that seemed to, you know, intensify all the diabetic, you know, kind of eye complications. And so he ended up having laser surgery. He ended up having, I think, a couple of different sessions with that and different aspects. And then he came in and he said, Doc, I don't want to lose my vision. What can I do? Now, I'm a little cagey, you know. I've been in practice long enough, so I wanted to milk this. You know, so I said,
we have to get our justice set out, right?
So I said, well, why don't you ask your eye doctor whether the diabetes has, you know, anything to do with this? So...
Oh, I love it.
You know, you just have, anyway.
You have to, like, little breadcrumb. Like, does this have anything to do with what I've been telling you about?
So he went and he came back. Yeah, my eye doctor said, yeah, I really need to get this diabetes under control. I said, okay, baby, game on. So we talked about it. I said, let's sugar, you know, we have to really be careful with that, you know, and we talked about grains, we talked about different things. And so now his hemoglobin A1C, and I don't know how many people know, it's basically a measure of what your average blood sugar is. So his normal a non-diabetic individual is between like 4.5 and maybe 5.5. His was, it actually had gone up over the previous 5 years. It was up to like 12.5.
Oh, dear. Like twice as much, more than twice as much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That yeah. So, I mean, he was running pretty sweet.
He's a sweet guy.
He is a sweet guy. And so after the talk, okay, we rechecked his A1C, which we had been doing every 6 months or so for a decade and a half,
yeah,
right? And it always been started at like 9.5, 10.5, 11, and finally 12. So the next time we checked it, it was like 7.5.
Wow. He cut it in half, almost just dietary changes.
Just dietary changes. Simple. And we didn't do anything else. Mm-hmm. And so it comes back to motivation. Uh-huh. He was a motivated camper.
Yeah. Vision or diet changes.
He didn't want to lose his vision. Mm-hmm. Well, that was his secret sauce.
And we all have that threshold. And I keep wanting to go back to what you said at the beginning is, can we make that threshold sooner where we're not giving up vision and mobility or life? Because by the time you get to that point, you might not have the chance any longer to pull the thread back,
right,
to come back where you are. And as you're talking about it and talking about the difference between life and death, the story came to mind that I heard when I was in school. And it's the idea that I think, imagine, it's kind of a morbid story, but it sticks with you that way.
Yeah.
They imagine there's this big river coming off the top of the hill, and down the river are bodies coming down, and they're bleeding and they're slashed, deep, deep gaping wounds. And so at the base of the river, you have your conventional doctors trying to cover up these wounds, suture them. They're bleeding out. This is life-saving medicine. And goodness, they need it, because they would bleed out without it.
Right.
But then you have integrative medicine going, I'm just going to walk up to the top of the hill,
see what's going on,
and see why people are falling down bleeding. And that's the idea of, can we take the time to walk up to the hill so that we don't have to bleed out at the bottom?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
And that can become the difference. So throughout all of these pieces, we went down a whole lot of different rabbit holes, which I love, and I feel like there are so many more we could do. But, you know, working in both worlds here and seeing the motivation of people, what's the one thing that you would like to see change, you know, in this transition of understanding between conventional medicine and integrative medicine?
The one, I guess my wish list would be, to me it really does come back to information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want people to be aware that I have a story for you, actually. that there are options besides just the way that we've always done it.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, there
it's
are
a whole
options.
New world.
And if people know that there are options, then they have the option.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I guess my wish list, I would love for everybody to, kind of be like me in a way, where I'll make the options.
Mm-hmm.
I will find the options. I can't make the population, want it more.
Right.
But I can. So here's my story. I have, let me see which patient I would best use for this. One of my patients, I'll call her Brenda. So Brenda's a young lady, sweet, sweet. Has a long history of anxiety for some very good reasons, actually. And,
mm-hmm.
And I've told her so. I said, what you've been through would basically choke most camels,
Yeah.
And I just wanted her to hear that. And I think that made her feel affirmed.
Seen for what you've been through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she just, but she's, she's an overcomer.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I was learning this stuff, I would, gently kind of offer her, we might want to think about, doing some testing, you know, some fundamental testing, or we might want to think about, you know, changing her diet around and that sort of thing. But, you know, she never was really that interested in it. It just because, you know, really she was kind of on a survival level, mm-hmm. you know, that she just didn't have the bandwidth, I don't think, to think about that. So you just keep on, you know, I never want to overdo it with patients. I never, you know, because my top priority with a patient of mine is the relationship comes first. You know, mm-hmm. I never want to do anything to threaten the relationship, because if they lose their relationship with me, then I don't know, maybe there are better doctors than me, better integrative doctors, but they may never find them. Right.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, it's like a compact, a covenant almost with my patients, you know, that, so, but over time, you know, I probably dropped the message, you know, maybe 6, 7, 8 times. Mm-hmm. Well, the last time that she was in, you know, it's like her mind is starting to, her heart is kind of starting to open up a little bit.
You know?
So now what were you talking about the last time, Dr. C, you know?
So more available.
Right. So, so information doesn't necessarily create sea change in everybody instantly, but it does something.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's kind of my, you know, philosophy. And I do that, that same sort of thing. Actually, I don't know if this is integrative. one of my favorite things to do over the years, you know, 30 years in practice, is help people quit cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I think it's integrative. I mean, it has so much to do with heart and lungs, and it's our overall health.
Yeah. So, and the way that I've handled that over the years is I'll just kind of gently, you know, bring it up occasionally with a patient that I know smokes. And at some point, 100% of smokers quit smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in most cases, it's before their mm-hmm. funeral.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes it is their funeral.
Okay. I like that statement, though. It's a little morbid, but I love it. 100% they quit.
Yeah. So, but in most cases, what I found is that if they come in, if a smoker of my mm-hmm. comes in and says, I have this issue. You know, maybe it's a cough. You know. Mm-hmm. Usually it's not quite that obvious, but so I'll then use, I'll say, oh, a cough. I'll, does that, no, actually my favorite is I'm getting a little winded now when I walk upstairs. So,
excuse me.
And so, so I'll say, well, so did you say that you smoke? Oh, yeah. Well, how much do you smoke? Well, I used to smoke a pack a day, but, you know, I'm down to like a third a pack a day. And also I'll say, well, does smoking make, you know, when you're smoking, does it make any difference with your breathing? And,
mm-hmm.
oh, yeah, it's, you know, so I'll just kind of milk it.
Yeah, you have to kind of lead the way with it.
Yeah. And so in it's really easy to get people to quit smoking,
mm-hmm.
Once they're motivated, once mm-hmm. there's a reason for them to quit. So anyway, that's
all
free.
Yeah. But you bring up some very good points, and I want to thank you for taking the time to come and talk with us today. as I reach the end of my ability to talk, is that we need to have both sides of the coin. We need to have the tools, the medications to make life livable when we're in that survival mode, or when we've let our health go so far that now it's the pill for the ill versus, you know, a quick descent into death. But with education and information and providers being able to work together and understanding where one degree of education sort of hits its ceiling of being helpful mm-hmm. and another can come in, there are so many more options than what we have been conventionally taught.
Right.
And that it's important to, you know, be open to all of them. And just Absolutely. The information is really the key.
Absolutely.
The truth will set you free.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
yes,
thank you,
yes.
Dr. Cunningham. I You're so appreciate welcome. You joining us today.
Yes. You're very welcome.
And thank you for joining us for another episode of the Healing Ground Movement. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it. Now remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help.